You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A little under a century ago, on November 11, 1918, the armistice ending World War I was signed, and it led to a relatively calm period until Hitler rose to power in the early 1930s. At least, that's been the received narrative until now. Robert Gerwarth, a professor of modern history at University College Dublin, complicates that storyline in his latest book, The Vanquished, Why the First World War Failed to End. In it, he explains that the lesser-known events that took place across Europe in those years, the civil wars, revolutions, interstate conflicts, outbursts of ethnic violence, and various refugee crises, should be paid a lot more attention to. The book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Gerwarth to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
How much of what we're seeing today is the legacy of what you're writing about here? There is the migrant crisis dividing EU countries, Vladimir Putin's push for an expansion of Russia's borders, the renewed strength of the National Front in France and its counterparts elsewhere in Europe, and there are conflicts and instability throughout the Middle East.
Yes, there's definitely an element of that. I wouldn't want to push the historical analogy too far. But in places like Ukraine, which you mentioned, or the Middle East, the First World War, and specifically the conflicts that followed the First World War, are still very present. And, you know, we can look at ISIS, for example, which, of course, always insists that what they want to undo is the post-war settlement. Or you look at, Ukraine, the former Western borderlands of the Russian Empire, lands that became independent in 1918. And Ukrainian nationalists, for example, always refer back to that period and the violence that followed.
I learned in high school that World War I ended at the 11th hour on the 11th of November, 1918, the armistice of Compiègne. But you argue that the war really ended in 1923. What happened in 1923?
Well, 1923 is the year that the Lausanne Conference took place, which actually ended the last of the post-war conflicts, which was the war between Greece and Turkey, extremely violent. I would say that the answer to your question whether the First World War ended in 1918 or not very much depends on geography. For Britain, France, and indeed for the United States, it makes perfect sense to argue that the First World War ended on the 9th of November, on the 11th of November, 1918. If you look further east, most of the combatant states of the First World War experience an extreme continuity of violence.
According to what you write here, 1914 Europe was remarkably stable. So why did the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie begin this chain of events that would lead to this terrible conflict, the war to end all wars, at least that's what they thought at the time?
Well, a colleague of mine, fellow historian Christopher Clark, argued, I think quite persuasively, that the big states, the big players in Europe, sleepwalked into the First World War. They anticipated a conflict, but one that would be finished by Christmas. And, of course, as we know, that was a big mistake. So what the First World War actually did was it led to a weakening of structures that were relatively stable.
The stability caused by the empires of Europe at the time. You write that by the 1930s, Central European Jews were looking at the vanquished dual monarchy of the Austro-Hungary Empire with nostalgia. So life had been better for minorities like Jews, I don't know about Gypsies, before World War I?
Yes, the pre-war empires have gotten a bad press for a very long time. But in fact, the idea that the Habsburg Empire in particular was a people's prison is very much a myth and an invention of the post-war nation states, which essentially accused the Habsburg Empire of having suppressed the various peoples. In fact, the multi-ethnic empire was actually, although far from perfect, but much better equipped to deal with diversity than the successor states.
And four empires ended after World War I. The Habsburg Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Hohenzollern Germany, Tsarist Russia, the Ottoman Empire. Was that an Allied aim during the war? Because the the major players, England and France, built up their empires as a result.
Yeah, 1918 is a strange moment for the history of empire. We have to bear in mind that up until the First World War and all the way until 1918, Europe is a continent which is dominated by empire. The entire world is dominated by empires. And that changes dramatically in 1918 with the collapse of century-old states such as the Habsburg Empire or the Ottoman Empire. The Western allies actually didn't declare their intention, didn't even acknowledge their intention to destroy the Habsburg Empire until very late, until January 1918. So up until that point, it was widely assumed that Europe would continue to be dominated by the land empires. So what survives then in 1918 and actually expands are the blue water empires, the British Empire and the French Empire.
German Empire in Africa is gone as well.
Yes.
A number of new countries were formed in the Middle East and in Europe, and both Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia have broken up since.
Yes, most of the states that were formed were aggressively insecure, but also in some ways built on very shaky foundations. So the idea that, for example, you mentioned Czechoslovakia, that Czechs and Slovaks would, as was previously promised, form equal partners in this marriage didn't work out. And also, the name Czechoslovakia does not represent the fact that there were more ethnic Germans in Czechoslovakia than Slovaks.
Which was an excuse that Hitler cited for invading Czechoslovakia.
Yes, many of the...
Freeing the Sudetenland.
Yes, many of the problems that are created in 1918 we encounter again in the 1930s. And Hitler, as the leading revisionist politician of the extreme right, was particularly keen on liberating, as he would have seen it, liberating the Sudetendeutschen from the suppression of the Czechoslovak state.
My guest is Robert Gerwarth, G-E-R-W-A-R-T-H. His book, The Vanquished, Why the First World War Failed to End. Was there violence after 1918 in the territories of the fallen empires?
Yes, there was a massive amount of violence. I estimate that at least 4 million people died in these conflicts, which are described in the book, between 1918 and 1923. So 4 million, that's more than the combined wartime casualties of Britain, France, and the United States. So we're looking at massive conflagration.
These are little civil wars?
Well, the
violence... Well, first of all, the Russian Civil War continued past the end of World War One.
Yes, there are. It's actually quite complicated because you've encountered different types of violence. There are revolutions and counter-revolutions. There are civil wars, but there are also almost traditional interstate wars because so many new states emerge with no historical boundaries. These boundaries are established by violence and conflicts. For example, the Polish-Russian War or the Greco-Turkish War.
And you say that as civil wars overlapped into revolutions, counter-revolutions, and border conflicts between emerging states without clearly defined borders or internationally recognized governments, post-war Europe between the official end of the Great War in 1918 and the Treaty of Lausanne in July 1923 was the most violent place on the planet.
Yes, the continuum of violence is quite remarkable, although part of my argument is that the nature of violence actually becomes transformed. It becomes actually much less predictable than violence which we encounter during an interstate war.
One aim of some of the new nation states that emerged after 1918 was the desire for ethnic and cultural homogeneity. Why did they? I mean, why didn't that happen?
Well, one of the big dilemmas, really, of this period is that the successor states to the multi-ethnic Habsburg Empire, but also the Ottoman Empire, want to be something that they cannot possibly be without bloody unweaving of different ethnic groups.
So there was ethnic cleansing.
Ethnic cleansing on a massive scale. I'll give you one example, namely, in the immediate aftermath of the Greco-Turkish War, hundreds of thousands of Greek Orthodox people have to leave the territory that is today the Turkish Republic, while at the same time hundreds of thousands of Muslims living in Greece have to are forced to leave the country in the other direction. So this is the first systematic attempt to create ethnically homogenous states. And it sets a very dangerous pretext, because the people who are watching this with great interest are politicians such as Mussolini and Hitler.
Well, Hitler supposedly cited the Armenian genocide as an example of what he was trying to do. He said, I guess it happened and nobody paid much attention. But to what extent did these conflicts help set the stage for the rise of Adolf Hitler?
Well, obviously, Hitler only comes to power in 1933.
This is after Mussolini. Is Mussolini another legacy?
Well, Mussolini, I think, is a more direct consequence of the conflicts that I'm describing here. So he's coming to power in 1922 as the first fascist prime minister worldwide. And of course, Hitler is trying to kind of learn the lessons from Mussolini. For example, he models his attempted putsch in Bavaria on Mussolini's march on Rome. But he also feels very strongly that violence basically pays. So you can intimidate your political opponents, and that will pay for you. So that's exactly what Mussolini did. So he intimidated political opponents while at the same time also pursuing a kind of legalistic strategy, which would see him, who actually created much of the violent problems that Italy experienced, that he would be seen as the savior, as the person who would be able to end the violent clashes on the streets.
You write about the far-left uprisings in Bavaria and Hungary. How did those conflicts play out? There's so much violence following post-World War I Europe. Was it a Pandora's box?
Well, the First World War, I think, was the unintentional enabler of the kind of violence that we see afterwards. Different kinds of violence, revolutionary upheaval. Obviously, the Russian Revolution, the successful Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, sets the stage. It's a real game changer, both in terms of international politics, but also because it inspires people. It either inspires people who desperately want violent political change, and those who are absolutely prepared to use violence to prevent it from happening in their own countries. So you see a mobilization of the extreme left, but also a mobilization of the extreme right at the same time.
Well, couldn't more of Europe have gone communist after the end of the Soviet Revolution?
Well, the communists in various states certainly tried. But as soon as communist regimes were established, for example, there was a successful communist coup in Hungary with Béla Kun as a temporary head of state, and the response of the radical right throughout Europe was quite extreme. So the extreme right tried to suppress left-wing movements in their infancy as soon as possible, precisely because they feared a repeat of what was happening in Russia, where initial resistance against the Bolsheviks was clearly and very quickly escalating into a civil war of epic and unprecedented proportions.
My guest is Robert Gerwarth, who's a professor of modern history at University College Dublin and director of its Center of War Studies. His previous books are The Bismarck Myth and Hitler's Hangman, The Life of Heydrich. The one we are discussing is The Vanquished, Why the First World War Failed to End. It is published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Robert Gerwarth. His latest book, The Vanquished, Why the First World War Failed to End, is published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. Winston Churchill wrote about World War I in a multi-volume work called The World Crisis, and you include a quotation from one of these volumes, The Unknown War, he wrote in 1931, at the beginning of your book. Wasn't Churchill trying to make sense of both the causes and effects of the Great War?
Yes, he's definitely trying to make sense of it, and he actually continued to do that until after the Second World War as well. He's interesting because he's, of course, very much involved in many of the kind of key decisions as a member of government.
Well, as somebody who played a role in the events of the time, how much did he get right in his book?
Well, I think it's an interesting contemporary take on it, and he gets a lot of things right, and he's also drawing attention to what he calls the unknown war. In other words, the violent conflicts that are going on in the East, conflicts which he, in another context, referred to as the wars of the pygmies, which wars that followed the wars of the giants between Germany on the one hand and Britain, France, and the United States on the other.
How much was known about what was going on in Russia during its civil war at the time?
Well, not too much, because many foreign correspondents had left the country immediately after the outbreak of the civil war. So the information was quite unreliable, and it came from certain sources, notably white Russian exilees, who, of course, hated the Bolsheviks with a passion, and told various, sometimes, of course, inflated stories about the nature of Bolshevism.
But then also other countries got involved in that war, sent troops, which led to long-term resentments after the Bolsheviks won their revolution. But also that civil war ended with more than 3 million dead. How does that compare with the losses Russia experienced during World War I when it was still in the war?
Well, Russia actually loses more people as a result of the civil war than it loses as a result of its involvement in the First World War, which I think is quite a remarkable fact. And it also helps to explain why it is such a traumatizing experience. So in the collective memory of the country, I think the civil war features a lot more prominently in Russia and other Eastern European societies than the war itself.
The Churchill quotation is ominous, quote, "Both sides, victors and vanquished, were ruined. All the emperors or their successors were slain or deposed. All were defeated. All were stricken. Everything they had given was in vain. Nothing was gained. Those that survived, the veterans of countless battle days, returned, whether with the laurels of victory or tidings of disaster, to homes engulfed already in catastrophe." Mm-hmm. Woo.
I think it's a very dramatic and powerful.
Was that just about the Eastern Front, or did he see that as applying to all of Europe?
Well, I think he's referring, among other things, to the, of course, the crisis of empire. I mean, politicians in Britain are well aware that although the its own empire has expanded as a result of the First World War and the acquisition of formerly German empires and the mandates, the League of Nations mandates in the Middle East, there's also the kind of the seeds of destruction are already there. I think Churchill is sensing that. And there's a sort of an imperial overstretch, and people at the time are already talking about it because there's a lot of resistance against the expansion of empire in the colonies. So if we look at demobilization movements after 1945, you can trace them back, of course, to the interwar period.
What about economically? Did Europe enjoy the same kind of financial boom that the United States did leading up to the Great Depression?
No, I mean, much of the defeated powers of the First World War do not see any significant economic growth.
Because there was no Marshall Plan, as there was after World War II.
There's no Marshall Plan, and many of the countries actually very much depend on American loans, short-term American loans, which proves to be disastrous, of course, when the Great Depression kicks in, because then these loans are recalled, essentially bankrupting a large proportion of businesses.
And in Germany, the Treaty of Versailles put a terrible financial burden on the German economy. Hitler used that as one of his arguments for coming to power and, I guess, later going to war.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that the Versailles Treaty is still seen out of context, if you like, because all the other defeated states obviously have to sign peace treaties as well, which are often actually much more dramatic than the Versailles Treaty. If you think of Hungary, for example, which loses close to 80% of its historic territory, that's a quite harsh treaty, which is unparalleled. There are differences in terms of the way in which these peace treaties are imposed on the vanquished. So if you compare the Versailles settlement with the big peace conference of the 19th century, namely the Vienna Congress after the Napoleonic Wars, not only do we have far more people sitting around the table, it's also a historic first that the defeated are not involved in the negotiations, whilst France was very much a partner for building a new secure international order. And I think that's one of the reasons why the post-Versailles order failed, because there was no buy-in from the vanquished.
A listener notes that the president of Czechoslovakia at the time had been so optimistic about change after World War One to little avail, and he wonders whether there were other leaders at the time who had similar high hopes.
Yes, it's actually a time, at least the immediate post-war period, is also a time of time for optimism. Optimism not only among the radicals, like the Bolsheviks, for example, or fascist leaders, but also among Democrats. If you look at Germany as the largest of the defeated states, there is initially a great deal of optimism and buy-in and belief that the democratic order will thrive. In the first general elections after the First World War, the democratic parties in Germany win a landslide. What is changing the mood then is the peace treaty, Versailles, and also the ongoing violence on the streets of Germany.
Have words like socialist and fascist lost their real meaning during the recent election? We had a lot of people on the right calling all Democrats socialists, and a lot of people calling Donald Trump a proto-fascist. What did fascism actually look like? And can it happen here, as that old line used to be, it can happen here?
Well, I think fascism, if we think of historical fascism, won't repeat itself precisely because it happened and because, thankfully, enough people still remember what fascism has caused, not only German fascism or National Socialism, but also, of course, Italian fascism, which is often seen as a benign form of fascism but actually cost the lives of over 1 million people.
What did it look like?
The fascist regime?
Mm-hmm. In Italy.
Well, the fascist regime in Italy started shortly after the Mussolini's takeover and the dismantling of the government. So from the mid-1920s onwards, it started with the prosecution of political enemies. So political enemies, members of the opposition, would either be killed or sent off to prison or remote parts of Italy.
And you write about a new logic of violence. What did that mean? How was violence directed at racial and religious minorities justified?
Well, what you see immediately after the end of the First World War, but already in some parts of Europe, for example, during the Armenian genocide in the Ottoman Empire, is an internalization of violence. So people are singled out and identified as enemies of the people or, in the case of Bolshevik Russia, enemies of the class, of the working classes. They're persecuted and killed. And I would argue that it's the totalizing logic of that these forms of violence which make it very different from a traditional war. Even the First World War remains in some ways a conventional conflict, of course on a huge scale, but it follows a different logic. So the logic is to force the defeated to accept certain terms of peace, whereas in the post-war conflicts, particularly in the ideologically charged conflicts and civil wars, there is no way that you can surrender. You cannot call off the Russian Civil War in the way that you call off the First World War on the 11th of November 1918. You cannot surrender. The idea is to annihilate certain segments of the population. So that actually makes it a lot more dangerous, uncontrollable, and points to the kind of violence that we see on the Eastern Front in the Second World War.
My guest is Robert Gerwarth, professor of modern history at University College Dublin, director of its Center of War Studies. His latest book is The Vanquished, Why the First World War Failed to End. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WMIC. I'm Leonard Lopate. Making a distinction between enemy combatants and civilians has often connected to what happened at Guernica during the Spanish Civil War. But you date it to the period between 1917 and 1923. What happened?
Well, one of the great achievements of the period before the First World War was to have a kind of internationally codified laws of war, the most important of which is the distinction between combatants and non-combatants. So the idea is that in the event of a conflict, you protect the civilian population, whereas the combatants are clearly visible because they wear certain uniforms. The lines between civilians and ordinary soldiers were already blurred during the First World War, but from 1917-18 onwards, they completely ceased to exist. So civilians are not only, as you would say, and I actually hate that word, but collateral damage, but they're actually deliberately targeted because, you know, in, say, interstate conflicts, one side wants to drive entire segments of the population out of the borders.
You write that the Freikorps, or volunteer German paramilitary units, which stamped out left-wing uprisings in the Weimar Republic and ran riot in the Baltic states, were the spiritual predecessors of the Nazis. Who organized them?
Well, they are volunteers, and initially the democratic government is calling on the formation of these volunteer groups precisely because they fear that a Bolshevik revolution will happen. So the German government at the time is actually social democratic, so you would probably call them socialists, but they're not communists. And they are concerned that the German revolution will escalate into something similar as the Bolshevik coup in 1917. So in order to prevent that, they are calling on mainly ex-members of the armed services in Germany, but also younger nationalist volunteers to put down the various left-wing risings. And by doing that, they are essentially calling on extreme anti-communists to settle scores. They've been waiting for that opportunity for a long time. So they crushed the various risings with extreme violence. And for example, in Berlin, over 1,000 people, mainly civilians of left-wing political persuasions, are killed in the process.
Without making any distinction, just simply you are there, so you must be one of the bad guys?
Yes, because they are not wearing uniforms, it becomes very, very difficult to distinguish who is who. So if you are accused of being a supporter of Bolshevism, that is very often sufficient to end your life.
And we're seeing similar situations today in Syria, for example, where people may very well be fighting for one side or the other, but since they're not wearing uniforms, it's hard to tell whether they are civilians or whether they're combatants.
Yeah, we've never really returned to a situation where the distinction between civilians and combatants is very firm. And unfortunately, the Syrian conflict, like so many other civil wars with external intervention, is a particularly violent form of conflict because people from the same communities are fighting each other.
The principle of national self-determination, which is commonly associated with Woodrow Wilson, obviously didn't work. Why did national self-determination come to mean ethnic cleansing in so many cases?
Well, it's a great liberal concept, but if you apply it to an ethnically and religiously diverse place like Central Europe or Central Eastern Europe, with a mind-boggling complexity in terms of the composition of the population, it becomes a disaster. It's basically an invitation to launch a violent campaign against others. And initially, in fairness, the peacemakers, including Wilson, insisted on the so-called minorities treaties. In other words, treaties that would secure the continued existence and the thriving of diverse communities. But as we see then over the next couple of the following years, up until 1923, there is a general sea change. People suddenly perceive the ethnically homogenous, the purified community as the only model that will guarantee peace in Europe.
Of course, Woodrow Wilson also could be accused of engaging in this kind of politics. He set up all sorts of things to separate blacks from whites and really discriminate against African Americans in this country.
Yeah, you see that, of course, in the way in which he treats the British and French empires. So he's remarkably silent on the rights of, Africans or Asians. What he has in mind is a new order, national self-determination for the white peoples of Central Europe. He's not really thinking about racial discrimination or whether that's a problem or not in the colonies.
Welcome to the year 2016. Robert Gerwarth, his latest book, The Vanquished, Why the First World War Failed to End, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.